Okay, ladies and gentlemen, dear guests, sorry I had to press you a bit to come in again, but we are supposed to finish by 5 o'clock because the bus for Titlis or for the station of the Titlisbahn is leaving by 5:30. So you have a half an hour just to prepare yourself. I just heard some people are not in this hotel. They have to go back to her hotel and coming back. So we have 1 hour for a discussion, and we would have the discussion here on the panel for maybe around 30, 35, perhaps 40 minutes. I think it will be exhausting. I hope so. And then, of course, you have the chance to ask your question. The title of this conference is Water, a Private or Public Good? And there's a question mark. And I think even more crucial is the question which comes out from this more general question, which means, what are the implications if water supply and water management is regarded as privately or as a publicly? And I hope we get some answers now from this panel, and of course some answers for you, though it's not the end of the day, but at least you get some wrap-up, some summary of what we learned yesterday and what we learned this morning. So I just would like to start with a question from Mr. Moss. You know, you explained us that if somebody who has a private company would like to step in water management, he has to keep a lot of restrictions, date, price, he cannot fix himself. So why should I, if I'm a private businessman, invest in or enter a business in water? What are the incentives?
The incentives are to deliver a service in counterbalance for a reasonable return. That is fundamentally what business is all about. An entrepreneur will look at a business opportunity, he will look at his resources, he will look at the risks, and he will make up his mind if he's going to put his money in water or in aerospace or whatever his strengths are in. I would not recommend for one moment that businessmen who know nothing about water and water operations rush into this sector. And we've seen in the recent years a number of companies that have rushed into this sector and regretted it. So from a point of view of the motivation is always an entrepreneurial motivation. And as far as I'm concerned, it always has these two extremes, providing a useful service on the one hand that people prepared to pay for, and getting a reasonable return on the other hand. And business is about balancing those two things.
But, you know, between my investment and the return, there should be a profit. Where is my profit?
The profit is part of the return. The profit is part of the return. It's the last part of the return that the businessman earns. It's the first part he loses. You can run a business for a while without making a profit, but you can't survive in business without making a profit. But the profit is the last part of the return. And that is where there's actually much less difference between operating a so-called public corporation and a private corporation is actually what do we mean by the component profit.
So where do you make your profits? Do you make profits, and where do you make it?
Of course we make profits. We have our costs under control, it's the same as in a private company. We have our prices fixed on a level that we can maintain it at least sustainable, that we have not too much changes in the price. And we make price adjustments when we have to invest too much or when our investment goes down, so we can reduce the price. Our prices for normal consumers are approved by the Stadtrat, by the government, but we do not have all our customers at that level. We have special customers which have their own pricing, and we do it ourselves.
But your motivation is not to make profit. You make profit to, you know, to have reserves, maybe to reinvest, but you don't have shareholders. You have to pay a share.
We have a shareholder. Shareholder is the holding, and It changed the situation last time. Now you have seen you have to invest more than before. We invest 50% more than we did when we belonged to the town. So it's a possible way to do it. But our motivation is to produce and maintain the good image for our company in the public, because we also have energy, electricity and gas, and there we are on the market. So the water business, the waterworks belongs to the holding because it's an opportunity to get a good image. And so we are very good, very well motivated to do a good job. And the price has to maintain that.
Again, to Mr. Moss, you know, to make a profit is the motivation for a businessman, of course, because maybe he has a shareholder, maybe himself want to have to get some money out of it, which is quite fair. But is there a possibility to make money with water? And, you know, as far as I understand from Mr. Rueck, the main motivation is not to make a profit. They have to make a profit, and it's nice if they get one, but it's not the motivation primarily which a water supply has, which is a public service. For a private company, of course, it has to be the motivation. So where is my profit when I invest in water business? Or where is the chance to get a profit? Because, you know, they said, for instance, pricing, I cannot fix. It's very important to fix pricing.
It is, generally speaking, and you have to be very careful about making generalizations, so I put everybody on warning. Most of this discussion will be about generalizations, which is a dangerous thing to do. But generally speaking, just as you've described, the prices are determined by the political masters on the operators in such a way that they can make a reasonable level of profit. If you want to make a big, big profits, you don't come to the water industry. That is quite clear. It's a low profit activity. Theoretically, it's a low risk activity, and those two things go together. One of the difficulties of the water industry is that low risk can change very suddenly to being high risk. You can have a cataclysmic event or a sudden change of conditions which shift the cost base phenomenally and move the business from being safe, low profit to what theoretically should be a very high margin business because it's a very high risk. And that is one of the reasons, one of the unintended consequences that one of the difficulties that I talked about earlier on of the kinds of problems that need to be resolved. So straight back to your question, by and large, it's a low risk, low profit business. And that's one of the reasons why a lot of companies, including the big energy companies a few years ago, were interested in the water business because it was a counterbalance to slightly higher risk, higher profit activities elsewhere. The difficulty with that argument, of course, is when you're into businesses that are only involved in the water industry, and there are plenty of businesses that are only involved in the water industry, and they have this juggling between risk and return, perhaps in a rather more acute way than those that are part of a bigger group.
Mr. Garrido, when could you imagine it is of a benefit to work with a private company, to outsource part of the water supply and give it to a private company?
Well, I'm not an expert in water supply to cities, but if you allow me to think about water services to other users, like irrigation, for example, we have long experience in irrigated districts in Asia, in Mexico, even in Spain, which are very poorly run. In Mexico, they reach a situation in which 1/5 of all their irrigated acreage out of 5 million hectares was not used because of the ruin, bad maintenance. The government wasn't raising the charges in line with the costs. And I think the records of the public administration of water supply for production is not very good. We haven't seen a lot of private companies entering the irrigation sector. There are reasons for that. But I think that there is opportunities for the private sector to find ways to participate in that, because food demand is increasing, productivity is needed, and you need irrigation districts that are well maintained and productive and with a sufficiently degree of reinvestment in engineering. So I see a lot of opportunities for finding niches of engineering, finding solutions. I think in a typical home in Europe, we are spending maybe 1% or even less than 1% of our income in water. How much are we spending in phones? You know, sum up the cell phones, the internet and everything, and we are spending very little on, in water. So eventually, companies may find opportunities for that. But I think that I can't answer your question on water supply because I'm not an expert in that.
But when you talk about Spain, could you imagine in Spain that private companies could solve the problem even better than the government?
Well, in Spain, we have a whole mixture of ideas. We have a big water company, which is ACBAR, is the Barcelona water supply that provides water services to 40%. It's a private company. It's providing water as a private company. We have public company in Madrid. We have a public service in Madrid. I think both are working quite well. The first one, the Barcelona one, has done a lot of investment in Latin America with very, very terrible problems, not everywhere, but in some cities. But I think that some private companies are doing a very good job in servicing different communities. In Barcelona, you have private areas. Others are public, so you have a mixture. And I don't think there is a conclusion about private companies being worse or better than the public systems. So you can find all kinds of systems.
So you say there are niches, you know, parts of the water supply or the whole water system where private companies can step in. Could you imagine for the canton of Lessons that you give to outsource some of your duties to a private company?
I think we had found a solution with our construction of EVL Energie Wasser Luzern, so there is no need to change that. But I'd like to give a comment on the explanation of Jack Moss before. I assume that water supply is not a low risk, it's at least a mid risk or a high risk business, because it's a very heavy business, it's a very strong investment. Our investment on the water works is around 150 to 200 million Swiss francs. That's a huge amount. The capital costs are around 80% of our overall costs. So if you have little change in rules to operate your assets, or if you have damages you couldn't imagine before, material degrades faster than you asked, the worth of the company will immediately reduce because your EVA, economic value added, or shareholder value drops significantly. So it's for the shareholder, it's a rather high risk if you think on discounted cash flow methods and so on.
What you say is right, and I think it's very important to look at the way the risk in companies is split up. That's partly to do with the different forms of contract that I expressed just now. The risk profile in one type of contract is very different from another. It is also very important to look at the difference in risks and returns between the risk and returns for the owner or the shareholder or an investor in a company. And a lot of investors who are not shareholders particularly look at the business as being a relatively low risk. This is why the Macquarie banks of this world are interested in the business, whereas people who are actually shareholders in their own right would have a different view and a different risk profile. So it's much more complicated than just to say, you know, you're talking about profit and risk. It's much more complicated than that. If you're a small, let's say, a two-person business operating a water supply in rural Africa, your view of risk and risk profiles and your financial engineering and everything is totally different from an ACBAR, which is spreading its risks and its investments over a portfolio of hundreds of contracts. And so whilst any one of those contracts at any point in time may be high risk. The portfolio is fairly stable. So we have to be very, very careful that we're not making all sorts of amalgams and shortcuts in this kind of discussion.
I still ask myself why I should invest in water. Maybe because it's a business which is safe, you know, and because I think water becomes scarce. I think there will be scarcity of water, maybe, or drinking water. So in future, you know, prices might rise. That is what people are afraid of. So if you talk to an investor and you have to counsel him, you know, he would want to know, how do you argue why he should invest in water?
I guess really we have most of Aquafed's members for whom this is a problem, because it isn't a problem for all of them, but it tends to be a problem for the bigger ones who have to court investors and have to look at their stock market prices and so on, which is a relatively small proportion of our members. What are the things that they really put forward to the stock market? I think probably the first thing is that they're experts in their field, and there aren't that many experts. So they're selling, first and foremost, their competence. Now, their competence depends on their track record and what they've done, and it also is how the market looks at their, which is exactly what you were talking about, their reputational profile. And so the good companies have got good expertise, and that enables them to sell their risk profile. The tendencies on the stock market and on the in the investment field today are to look now at more than just the levels of profit. People are beginning to look seriously at the social value, the environmental value, and so on of these businesses. And there, water and sanitation companies score very highly indeed. So people are beginning to get a different perception of the value and the risk. And I think this is for a very good reason, that the world at large is beginning to pose some very serious questions about capitalism as it seems to be evolving. And there's some counter-movements to that, which I think are very useful, because they're bringing the business back into business and diminishing a bit the weight of some of the financial issues we've just been talking about. So those are actually helping, that tendency is actually helping the kind of businesses that I'm representing. But the first answer is, first of all, expertise, secondly, skill, and perhaps a perception of a growing need. But I don't think that's yet very strong.
So it's more for reputation. You invest in a water business than for profit. Reputation. You get a good reputation as a company, you have invested in...
Those are the arguments we have to use to the stock exchange. They're also the kind of arguments we have to use to... municipal or government clients. We have to demonstrate that we're competent. We have to demonstrate that we have a good reputation. Those are very important, and they're very important to our end users, our customers, because they need that trust, that confidence that we've been talking about. So that's the bit that's really important, I think, is the you can use this expression, the balance between good, competent service delivery and the trust that you gain by doing that.
Coming back to Spain again, you said you have hundreds of examples of different collaborations in Spain. Maybe you could explain one or two where maybe the private sector has acted very successfully, and the state and the public and all the stakeholders profited from a stepping in of a private company.
I think perhaps the best successful example that we have in Spain is Barcelona. And there are reasons for that. One is that Barcelona has it's home to the largest private company of water in the country, and the company has operations in many areas in the world. And they're doing a good and a very balanced interface with farmers, with groundwater resources. The best examples of groundwater resources management in Spain is leaded by the water company in Spain. So you have one example of a private company that seeks to benefit the shareholders, to provide a dividend, and to grow, leading the groundwater resources in the area of the city. And that's been going on for 40 years. So we have one example in which the private sector combines the interest of the farmers, airport area, other users, and provide a sustainable use of very critical groundwater resources right on the coast. So another thing is technology development and application. I think private companies of a given scale have more incentives to develop new ideas, to develop technologies, and I believe you need some scale to do that. So this is one good example. There are bad examples of private companies. I'm not familiar with any, but I think that I think the incentives to develop ideas, technology systems come out when you have a certain scale, and then you invest in new innovativeness. Let me mention one thing that it came to me. I think 2 weeks ago, I read in the newspaper in New York Times that in the U.S. there is some evidence growing up that the water quality, tap water, is becoming much better than the bottled water. So.
It's always been the case.
I don't know if it's been the case or not, and I'm not. But it's becoming, in the U.S., where bottled water was becoming a big business, and you saw everyone with a bottle of water, and now it's becoming clear that tap water is better, it's healthier. And in a sense, that gives you an idea that sometimes if you run a system, either public or private, that you know doesn't brand the bottle and doesn't bottle the water, could be a better product than what private business the bottled water can do. So I think, for me, that was very, very.
And what was the reason the water supply has, or the water quality has improved in the States? You know?
No, I believe the bottled water in the U.S. is very different from the one that we have in Europe, where you have to. The bottled water have to meet a very, very strict standards on the springs that you can tap. In the U.S., you can bottle all kind of industrial water. I think it's a different business, but it tells you that when you look into when you analyze what the product is being serviced through the tap and in the bottle, then you can even beat the other one. So that's I don't know the reasons, but I think it's something that we can must think about.
You had a quite clear stand. In your speech about the private sector, he has not to step in the water, but you do it perfectly. But when you listen now to the two gentlemen, they said, you know, there is more innovation, there is more, what we heard of yesterday in the speech of Mr. Barake, he said, you know, there is more demand view of business and not so much a supply view of business as maybe the traditional water supplier has. Why are you so restrictive in the entrance of private sector in this water business?
Maybe that's because there is some change of the behavior of the traditional water suppliers, waterworks. We as a company are extremely customer-oriented, and maybe the town city would not like to hear it, less to the shareholder, a little bit, but forget it. We are customer-oriented, and by that, we are innovative as a company, and as an industry, water industry in Switzerland, we are in cooperation with the EAWAC and other innovative waterworks in Switzerland. We are there developing new treatment processes for water, and we are a little bit concerned. Because we thought that the commercial industry, the companies which normally deliver parts of these plants, have a know-how which we can learn from. That's not true. The know-how now in the waterworks is better than from our suppliers. And we have to make the experience. In Switzerland, we organized a competence network from all the specialists from waterworks in Switzerland to hold the know-how together and to develop it further and to bring it to more people than before. So we don't think that in Switzerland, and I think the same is true for Germany and Austria, because I know there that the environment, there's no need for innovation from Veolia, however. I think more they have some problems there. Is there innovation and is there know-how? Maybe I have a special view, but in Switzerland we are now in a very, very innovative way. It's a concept, Wave 21.
I can't really answer that because I'm not a I'm not a technician and I wouldn't attempt to. But I certainly know that some of our members, and as I indicated right at the beginning, certainly work on technologies and sell their technological skills. Probably not aimed at the kind of markets that you've just talked about, because those are not really markets that are open to them anyway, for all the emotional and historical reasons that you've explained, and they don't really make a big effort to try and penetrate those markets. So there's probably a very good explanation of why the technologies that you're looking for are not necessarily coming from those companies, because there's not a market. If that, again, that word is something you have to be extremely careful about using in this discussion, the word market. We all use it very loosely, I think we have to recognise that there are some market forces in the water and wastewater industry that we've been talking about, but there is certainly not a conventional market in the sense that we think of a market for this stuff, for which there is a market, but very
different. But you mentioned, or you said yesterday, is that the word privatization is maybe misguiding, because when we talk about privatization, we immediately think all the property rights goes to the investor. He owns the water. That is, you know, the idea and the fear of many people. And he fills it in bottles, and you won't get water anymore on your tap or bad quality. And we're all forced to buy this water when we want to drink. And those who can afford, they get it. And the other one have to look how they get their water. So what means privatization exactly, according to you?
For me, the word privatization has a very, very specific meaning. And as I said in my presentation earlier on, I only know of two countries where it's taken place. One is one is England and Wales, not even the whole of Great Britain, and the other is Chile. And in those two countries, and those two countries only, the state-owned water companies were sold, assets, liabilities, the lot, to private investors. The water was not sold, and in those two countries, the privatized companies do not own the water. They pay license fees, they pay extraction fees, they have all the controls that you would expect for this kind of thing, and the same on their discharges for wastewater. To me, that is privatization. The rest of it is what I call, in my language, delegated management or public-private partnership contracts, which I think is, you know, where you were talking about only. I'm really interested in the outsourcing, the public-private partnership-type contracts. I'm not particularly interested myself in the privatization in the pure sense. But there we've got a label that's been very loosely used by some, but used deliberately to create misunderstandings and to make exactly the amalgam that you've made between, you know, this and losing your water and profits and all the rest of it. And the kind of common ground, which I feel very strong between the two of us, when we really start talking about what's the hardcore of the business. Just to complete the anecdote, I know that the two biggest members of our organisation have both sold on several occasions companies that they've acquired in the bottled water business, because it is nothing to do with their business at all. It's a totally different business model.
But still, when you say, of course, the water is not owned by the investor, but... Yeah. Maybe the taps, you know, the distribution channel is owned. So let's take the case of Britain, you know, because when you live in London and you open your tap and you get a bad water quality, and when you went to your letterbox, you get a bill which raises every week. So you have no choice. You cannot enter, you know, the well of the city and get your own water in a bottle. So you are forced. You have no choice. Of course, you can buy water in the supermarket.
So you have actually no choice either in a city that's run by a public company doing exactly the same job.
I have a control. I can, you know...
You have exactly the same control in the public sector and the private sector. And this is the point I was making about the separation. Mm. You, in many public situations, there is no real control because there is that separation doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And so if there's a little bit of a problem with the water supply, the mayor, instead of saying get it fixed, ignores it. Because if he had to get it fixed, he'd have to put some money up. And so in reality, there is no guarantee of stronger control because the operation is operated by the public sector or the private sector or the community sector. And somebody made the comment about, you know, would you trust government? You have to be very careful about trusting governments. You have to be careful about trusting private companies too. Absolutely right. And one of the arguments I would put across is, why do people expect to have private companies very heavily regulated when the next door neighbour is a public company and it's not regulated at all? That, I think, is a very significant question that is very rarely addressed.
By the way, you mentioned this example of the London water supply. Do you know what went wrong and what happened later? Just very briefly.
My perception is that the pipelining system has been a bad state when it has been privatized. But afterwards, maybe the contract has been not optimal made, but it seems that the profit has been more interesting for the company than the repair of the pipelining system. Maybe the reality is even complex, I know. For me, what I learned by that, it is very difficult and, from my opinion, not really feasible to find a regulation and find contracts which fulfill all the necessary conditions to do it in a good way. There are always some lacks or other interpretations, or if it is read by lawyers, they have another interpretation what is intended. So it is very hard to control a business if it's based on regulation rules and on contracts. I think that's maybe it has been a learning process in London, but I think it is an implicit difficulty with contracts, because it's contracts. The main aspect is you have juridic stability, in German Rechtssicherheit. That's hard to fit with the real needs. A little bit long explanation, maybe.
I don't know the case, but in London there might be a bad contract.
Well, there is no contract in London. No. This is one of the difficulties. The whole British system is based on a 25-year license. So while the companies bought the assets, in reality they don't really own them because they only have a 25-year license. But then perhaps they do own them, because since the privatisation took place, the license has become a rolling license. So now it's always 25 years long. One could say this is not perhaps the clearest approach to have said. But I think I agree to a very large extent with what you just said, and I made the point very clearly in my presentation that a contract is essential, but it's not sufficient. And I think, again, this applies to all operators. It doesn't matter which side of the thing. They need clear objectives, clear terms, the 6 hours that I was talking about. But no lawyer is clever enough to write a contract that works like that. The situations change all the time. You hit all sorts of unexpected problems. And so there is of necessity a partnership. And a partnership is more than a contract. A partnership is a real will to work together to find solutions. And I think the licensing system and the regulation system and, of course, the politics in the UK has become very conflictual. And that is a real weakness, because that means that between the operator and his investors and the three different regulators that exist in the UK and three different levels of government, there's lots of room for misunderstandings and lots of room for contract and lots of room for tensions. And yes, I think there have been problems with the technologies that have been used at times with the pipelinings. There have also been huge difficulties because the operators have not been given access to be able to dig up the pipes because the mayor is facing an election and he doesn't want to have his voters walking and driving up and down streets that are full of trenches. The realities of life are you can't have everything all the time. You can't have your cake and eat it, as you say in England. So the problem is more complex than simply non-performance.
You mentioned the word trust as well. You both mentioned the word trust. Trust has to be the base of a contract as well. So for the last few minutes on this stage here, before we come to the public, I would like to raise another question, which is more, the framework of the discussion we had today and yesterday. Yesterday night there was the statement that water is a human right. Water is a human right. That is what the NGO says. Maybe it's access to water, maybe it's a human right. Do you agree? Is that right? And what is, under what conditions this human right has to be a human right? Maybe we start with you.
Go ahead.
I fully agree with water being considered a human right for the most basic needs of the humans, like drinking, safe water, and having a minimum amount to have a sanitation and health. I consider that. That's very cheap to fulfill in these times. So I think it should be considered as that.
I think it's not so cheap because there has to be conditions. There's also a human right on food. But there has to be conditions to get the food. You need farmers, you have to pay for food. You don't get food for free. Yesterday we thought water should just be free. It's a human right, like air.
I'm not claiming that it should be for free. I think you should have a reasonable access to a minimum amount of water that you can pay with the extent of your income, which may be zero or maybe something more than zero. We are seeing in many Latin American cities, big cities, that the public sector supplies water to the cores of the cities, and you have millions of people living in the surrounding areas, which are supplied by the private sector at 8-10 times more than the core of the cities. And I think that's something that you have to really address. And I think it's not so expensive to provide reasonable water at a reasonable price to millions of people in Latin America, maybe not in Africa.
We are in practice confronted with the question if water is human right if somebody don't pay the bill for water. So there's a question, have you the right to stop the supply or not? Our answer is in Lucerne. We have the right to stop it because there are 150 fountains in the town. Everybody can go there, put the water and use it. That's one part of the answer. The other one is right for how much water. The human needs, let's say, 5 liters per day, not 160 liters or 300 liters per day. So that's this part. The other question has been, should water be for free? I would say yes, if it's for public waterworks, for public water supply. But what costs are is for treatment, transport, and delivery, and also on and control. That has a price.
So if you get on a fountain in the city of Lucerne, where it just comes out of that's for free, but at home you have to pay.
Yes, no. And 50 fountains of the town have pure spring water for free.
I've given evidence to the Human Rights Commission twice on defended the right to water. But in doing so, I believe there are a whole lot of very dangerous aspects to just taking it as a right without thinking very, very carefully about it. And I think I could spend an afternoon on the subject. Yes, it's a right, and yes, all of the reservations that have just been made here are very valid. Perhaps the most important thing is, does it make any difference? The UN Human Development Report for last year, 2006, made very clear that it thought that the concept of defending the human right to water without delivering on it is one of the biggest crimes against humanity. And I didn't quite use that term, but that's what it meant. Declaring a human right and doing nothing about delivering it. And remember what I said, nearly half the people on this planet don't have satisfactory water supply systems. That's what we really should be thinking about, not whether intellectually we have a human right or not. So my fundamental thing is, yes, it's a right, but what really matters is delivering that right, delivering it every day reliably to everybody. And that is an enormous challenge that society today faces.
I think that's a moment you can ask your questions. Maybe you still have questions in mind after the speeches, or questions which came up within the last 2 days. Or maybe you have some comments on what the gentleman just said now. Yes, the lady, please.
So this is a question I've been curious about for some time, and I mean no implied criticism whatsoever. But I live in Zurich, and when I'm at home, I drink the tap water. And if we went to a conference like this in the United States, there would be tap water on the tables. And I'm very curious as to why it is that bottled water is so prevalent in Switzerland when the tap water is such good quality. And especially at this conference, it seems just a tad ironic for us to be paying the 2,000 euro per cubic meter rather than the 2 that we could pay with the tap water.
Water is a question of marketing. It's a marketing product. That's a marketing product. That's a question of positioning that to lifestyle. What we see in interviews that there is increasing amount of people which really drinks tap water.
I think this one, I guess, is for Jack. I think you've made a persuasive case that if the public sector is doing its job right in the regulatory structure, it's essentially indifferent, theoretically, between a private sector delivery or a public sector delivery. That, I mean, obviously then turns it over to which could be most cost-effective, which can raise investment funds and so forth. But could you sort of talk through what your thought process would be if, say, you're the governor of Jakarta and you're trying to decide whether to privatize, or let's say not privatize, to have the functional operation of the water system be private versus public? How would you go about thinking that through, and what analysis would need to be done?
I wish you hadn't picked the example of Jakarta, because I happened to negotiate the contract for one of the contracts in Jakarta. And I can see that just so heavily from the private sector side, it's quite difficult for me to put myself in the shoes of the other guy, I suppose. Jakarta is an enormous city, growing incredibly fast, with 10 years ago a very chaotic situation indeed. Corruption rife, huge amounts of investments going into the water supply system, theoretically from the World Bank, very little of it arriving where it should do. Very good quality water treatment plants, in theory, totally destroyed by bad management. So what we did as private operators was to demonstrate what are the problems and suggest ways by working with the public authorities that we would help them to solve those problems. And that was the view that we took then, and that's still the view we take, is to try to share the problems that the governor of Jakarta has. And very much using the argument that I was using, if you create the separations and create the clarity, you strengthen all the links of the chain. And I think that's what's been happening in Jakarta since those days. The political control, the real political control over the water supply, has got much stronger. There is now a regulatory system in place that didn't exist before. There are now 2 private sector operators working in different parts of the city, offering a service that can be compared. So it's not just that there's one operator, there are two operators, and their performance can be compared. I wouldn't say that everything in Jakarta is rosy. There are still plenty of problems to solve in Jakarta. They're due to many things beyond really the control of either the public or the private parties in playing. But the thesis that I started from, the partnership is the essential, is working in Jakarta, and that's what I would still sell, I think, to the governor if I was trying to do it again today.
Wolfgang Kinkelbach, please. Okay.
My question is along the same line, and I like Deng Xiaoping's pragmatism, who says it doesn't matter whether the cat is white or black, the main thing, it catches the mice. So I don't care whether it's private or public, as long as there is a good and efficient water supply. But my question is now, if I look at Zurich Waterworks, who is a non-profit organization and who do a terrific job, if the same job would be done equally well by a private firm who has to have some profit, how much more expensive would the water be? Would it be more expensive, or could they do something in terms of efficiency which Zurich Waterworks cannot do, or would it be more expensive, and then probably how much?
Would it be more expensive if a private company would do it in Zurich or maybe in Luzern?
Depends on the contract.
Let's be honest. We haven't a clue. Yeah. No, we don't know. You cannot have two operators doing the same job in the same city at the same time. That's a fundamental problem of a natural monopoly. So the question is a very interesting question, but it's totally hypothetical, and there is no answer to a hypothetical question.
But there are some answers possible, I think. What would happen if it would be a private-driven company? They would reduce their innovation forces. I'm sure about that, because they have no immediate benefit in the next 7 years. So what we'll have is the same quality maybe, but in the long term, you have a less innovative company, and you will have, I would assume, a degradation of the amount of renewal of the network immediately, because you don't see it the next 5 years. So we'll have the problems after 10 years, but very strongly, on quality side and on pipeline side. I see from the natural business tools and the natural business principles, no way to do it another way if it's a private company. If I would own that company as private man, as investor or manager, I would do it like that. And I don't see any reason why another private owner should it be different? No way.
Well, that's a hypothetical answer on the bias side. Maybe we ask you. You are in the middle.
I think Zurich is one of the most wealthiest city in the world. It's very well organized. It's Swiss organized, and I think it's not the proper example to ask. And I think we should think. I mean, this question should be posed for hundreds of many other cities in the world, which are in the process of going one way or the other. And I think there is although it's hypothetical, there is empirical work that can shed light on what works and what doesn't work. And I think we should, in looking into the future and answering to the challenge that Jack was made, is there are billions of people that need an answer and a different income level. So we have to think about this. Not Zurich is too perfect to ask the question, I think.
Yeah, please. Short comment.
For Jakarta, I would support a privatization. Sure, no doubt. The situations are very different, and Dona has to find the solution which corresponds to the environment.
There's a good business saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I don't think Zurich's broke. Yeah. Jakarta certainly was and is still in a pretty poor state, and there are lots and lots of Jakartas. There are also an awful lot of Zurichs. We shouldn't really worry ourselves too much about that. I'll come back to the point you just made. Where people are in trouble, that's where we need to be working.
As a gentleman with... you have been first. You? No, you just look back. Yes, sorry. You're next. You're next.
As I was cited with my Polish pro-market remark, I wanted to bring up the other comment I was discussing with Mr. Moss in the break. I think in the beginning the business, a private model would be more efficient and also more innovative. But you need a good lawyer, a very good lawyer, to design those deals, those contracts. That's what you mentioned as well. And the problem is that especially for small communities, it is they are lacking the competencies, and you need to know how to design those deals. Otherwise, you'll have a bad service. This makes transaction costs very high. And so you need to consider on a pragmatic basis, and that's where I'm with you. If you can afford to externalize or to hire somebody private, including those costs for the contract. And yeah, that would be the remark we discussed already at the break.
Okay, thank you. The gentleman behind you.
Yeah, I would state that you at AVL are on the leading edge in efficiency and in innovation in Switzerland. And so what you say is right, in a way. But I would state if the Swiss water providers would commission some parts of their business to the private sector, the efficiency would improve a lot. For example, billing. If you know that in many Swiss communes, you have to write down as house owners your water meter, then you have to send it to the company, and the company writes a bill, and the bill comes to you by post, and you can all do with electronic billing and with electronic internet coverage is 90% in Switzerland. So I would say there is a lot of efficiency gain possible, and there is also room for then profit for the private companies.
We made, together with ETH, big survey and analysis of the gas market. There we have seen that, in contrast to what we expected, there's practically no scaling effect for gas networks. So in some ranges, if it's not too big or too small, normally you have this scaling, no scaling effect in the operating and in the maintenance of the network. Of course, you have some benefits if you have newer technologies, for instance, for the building. But small waterworks work very efficient because most of them is not paid. But the problem what I have with the small waterworks is that not all have the professionalism which is needed. And our concept is not to privatize, but to work together, to make corporations, associations, higher competence, maybe for some of the neighbor waterworks or from a private company. We are not the leading edge. I think Zurich is the leading edge, but we're working also together with Zurich. And we use, of course, we use external experts for some questions. We do not know all, as everybody does. So outsourcing and having advice, that's a normal part of the business.
And it's part of the private business as well. I mean, our big members don't do everything themselves. On the other hand, they often can, to get over some of these transaction and scale problems, they can group a lot of small contracts locally. The bigger operators can do that. So there are very often swings and roundabouts. And again, I caution against making generalities. In France, for example, where there are a huge number of very small contracts run contiguously by operators, there's a lot of the benefits of sharing, and transaction costs are reduced through standardization and so on. In other countries where there is no established widespread private operators, that option is not available, and they have to turn to other solutions.
There was a gentleman. You had a question.
in water management, wastes should be avoided, mainly in agriculture. Are private suppliers interested in avoiding waste because they earn as more as they sell more water, so they want to sell more and more? It's about the same problem as electricity market. We should use less electricity, but suppliers wants to sell more. So I see here a structural problem.
So you say water suppliers would like to sell more water because they get more income. Would you agree?
Well, there have been very few cases of privatization in the irrigation sector. One example is New Zealand. Irrigation district was privatized. It was sold at a negative price. So farmers were given money to get the property of that. But I think they're working much better than in a public systems. And although at the present time it's very difficult that the private sector will ever become interested in servicing irrigators, because in fact, if you look in the long term, farmers are usually expecting that when something is really needed in the irrigation industry to get fixed, then the government will step in and solve the solution. So I don't think it's a similar case. I think we're dealing with a different animal.
I know of one case where a private sector is running irrigation, and it is precisely to reduce waste, to increase the resource available for the public municipal supply. So it's an ancillary activity, yeah, specifically to reduce the agricultural waste so there is more water available for public supply. I think the word waste is very important. As you probably know, most water supply systems leak to some degree, and leakage is clearly waste. Overselling is another issue, and certainly reducing the waste in terms of losses from the network or losses from non-recovered bills is a very serious concern for private officers, a very serious concern. Having said that, it's not quite as simple as it would sound, because reducing waste and reducing losses has a cost. And there becomes a time, depending on the cost of your inputs and your revenues, where it is uneconomical to reduce the waste beyond a certain point. People find it very hard to grasp, but the economical limits of waste reduction in the water and wastewater, well, in a water supply system, is a very difficult question to resolve as well. So, like all the things I've said, it depends. But it depends for very good reasons.
Okay, I think we have to come to an end here. Just one final question to each of you. I would like to know, the title of this conference is Water a Private or a Public Good? Or we can say, is it more efficient and more to the needs if water is managed publicly or privately? A very short answer. What would you answer on this question if you have to put it in a few sentences?
Okay. Water resources
30 seconds.
Okay. Water resources are public matter. Providing service related to water or in water, that's open to many options for all kinds of institutional and organizational arrangements. But public resources, water resources is a public thing.
Your statement?
I have a problem with the word or. I don't think that's the right way to frame the question. I think under certain circumstances, water is a public good, and the same water, a few moments later, is a private good. And I think the real difficulty with water is how do you allocate the same water to be sometimes a public good and sometimes a private good and sometimes a public good again. So the question, in my view, is water is a public and a private good, and that presents a few conundrums.
And your statement?
Water resources are, in principle, a public good. The organization of the distribution and the providing the supply of the water is a question of the society, what preferences they have. In Jakarta, there is an other optimal solution than in Switzerland. In Switzerland, there is no chance for privatization.
Okay, I thank you, gentlemen, for answering the questions and for your talks, and I thank you for listening and asking your questions. Now, the bus leaves by 5:30. I think it's just up in front of this hotel, is that right? So, main station. Main station, yes. Where is the main station? Maybe you... I think you will find it. It's the main station of the Engelbergbahn. See you later, and thank you for coming.